This episode of the DubDub Review is sponsored by the Theme Park Brothers. Are you looking for YouTube videos that feature some of the great holiday decorations at the Walt Disney World Resort? Check out their recent footage of the Magic Kingdom and Hollywood Studios. Are you looking for resort walkthroughs? Well, check out their recent footage of the Saratoga Springs, including a boat ride to Disney Springs. Are you looking for some YouTube videos that feature a Disney Cruise Line? Well, check out their full walkthrough as well as their 7-day adventure on the Disney Fantasy Cruise Line. Again, that's the Theme Park Brothers on YouTube.
Hello and welcome to this week's very special episode of the DubDub Review Podcast. I am your host for this gargantuan monster, fantastic holiday extravaganza of episode 100.
Stacy, can you? I'm going to do it too. Could you give us a little horn action here? You got any of that for you, Pete? I mean, you said gargantuan. Close. All right, Pete.
So, in case anybody hasn't noticed, this is our official episode 100.
Official?
Officially. Okay. We have a couple like bonus episodes where technically we had 100 episodes out like 2-3 weeks ago, something like that.
A couple weeks ago, yeah.
Yeah. But this is the big 100. We have been on the air for 2 years now.
Pete, we call those in golf mulligans, all right, just so you know. We kind of forget about some of those strokes, and we just count the real ones, all right, just so you know. So.
Ah, okay.
That's how we're going to do it. Like,
do-over.
Do-over. I didn't mean that. All right. I'm sorry. So,
that's all right. We've got a pretty big guest for today. First, I want to know what's going on, what's good in your guys' lives, besides the fact that we made it to 100.
Okay, ladies Stacey, first.
Stacey, how about you? What's going on good?
All right, so I just finished off a couple weeks at work that were extremely busy, and so I'm feeling finally like I can really enjoy the holiday season. I kicked off that today with a 5K. We did the ugly sweater run downtown Chicago at Soldier Field. Yeah.
Another PR, right?
Yes. So I've done 3 5Ks now, and each time I've gotten a little bit faster. So this time was the fastest so far. And it was just a really, really fun race. And we got to see Santa, and Griffin ran with us this time. He's our 10-year-old. So that was really fun. And it was just like, I feel now like I can enjoy the holidays.
Good girl.
Yeah.
You've gone running crazy.
I know. Well, we really like racing. So even Scott today said, you know, this is really addicting. So we're looking for the next one.
You should try with cars. That's even more fun.
That might not
work. It's way more expensive. I will give you that, but it is more fun. Man. Yeah, the air conditioning, the radio.
The heater.
Yeah.
There you go.
So, Pete, let me give you mine here, okay? I want to tell you, so I've been off of work for about a week and a half now. This is kind of the slow season in the golf industry, so I've got a stretch here where I'm using up some vacation time. So,
really?
You know, I'll be honest.
I wasn't have snow yet. Well, we could totally golf right now.
You could golf, but I'm not going to be there. So I wasn't sure how the holidays are going to be this year. You know, my father passed away. I wasn't sure I was going to take the holidays. It's gone the opposite way. Like, actually, I've been really excited for the holidays. I've done things this year that, like, I didn't think I would tackle. Like, everybody received a Christmas card. Literally. Everybody received a Christmas card. I sent them out to people that, you know, actually what I decided to do was I sent them out to pretty much anybody that I could think of. If you and I are buddies, you got a Christmas card. If you and I are acquaintances, you got a Christmas card. If you and I don't have a great relationship, you get a Christmas card. I sent Christmas cards to everybody. You know what? I told Tamara yesterday in a text, I'm trying to actually lead and live like the Ebenezer Scrooge that wakes up on Christmas morning. That's the version I want to bring at Christmas time. And it's been awesome. Like, everything I do has been like positive and moving forward. So I couldn't mm-hmm. be happier. And I'm hosting tomorrow at my house a brunch for some of the best people I know. So I'm getting together with...
Can I crash anyway?
You can crash. You are coming. Stacy, you and your family are coming. Amy and Tim and their family, they're coming tomorrow to the Malik house. And it's not exclusive. It's just simply the Chicagoland people. I asked Laura. I asked Scott Gerke. It's just the local Chicagoans who could realistically make it. And I'm looking so forward to that as well, too.
We are, too.
Awesome.
I've got rapping. Oh, man.
Peter, come on. I want you to bring something. What do you got? Tell me something really good.
I just said I have rapping to do. You obviously, I'm bringing something.
No. Give me something good in your life. No one punched you in the throat today at work?
Nobody punched me in the throat after two straight days at work.
This is good.
Things are just kind of going along right now, and for me, that's good enough.
Good enough.
I don't need everything to be like three clicks above board here, and status quo is good for me sometimes. I'm a very simple person that way.
That's why I love you. That's why you ground me in my thoughts too. That's why I love you. So, hey, let's get into the show today. All right, we've got a great show. You guys, I know we talked about this. I want to introduce to you guys. Actually, we got a segment. We interviewed a great Disney historian. You've heard of Jim Corcus before?
Mm-hmm.
You know how many books he's got published?
Roughly 20 or so, I think.
20 books. He writes the article for the DVC Files magazine. He actually, I didn't mention this. He appeared on one of the travel promotional videos. He was the lead character on one of the Come to Disney type programs they sent out in VHSs for a year.
Oh, cool.
Oh, yeah. You can YouTube it.
I got to find that one.
Oh, it's a hoot. It's a hoot. So I want to go and actually air the segment. We did a great interview with Jim, especially for our 100th show. So without any further ado, the WDW Review show number 100 interview with Jim Corcus. Hey, Pete and Stacy. So, you know, what my connection is with Disney is, I really love the storytelling. So I wanted to have a special guest on for our 100th show. And I've heard this gentleman speak before on other podcasts, and I own several books. As a matter of fact, I brought his book alone on a cruise, and it made the cruise all that much more exciting to have his book there. I want to take the time to introduce a Disney historian, Jim Corcus. Jim, how are you?
Gosh, I'm great! And what a wonderful time of the year, Christmas holiday season, because just like Christmas, Walt Disney and his heritage brings joy to the world, just as your podcast does. And so those who are out there listening are getting this special holiday treat. So I'm very excited. Oh, gosh, thanks. yes. So how would you like to get started?
Jim, I want to ask you, I've got about 38 questions that I've got to ask you, if that's okay. No,
Gosh, nobody expects the Spanish Inquisition, especially on such a friendly podcast.
No doubt. But let's be honest, I've got my hands on Jim Corcus right now. I've got several books in front of me. I've heard him on Rod Wheaton's show. I've heard him on Lou Mangiello's show. And we finally have him on the WW Review, so I couldn't be happier. But I want to know, if you would please allow me one question, is essentially, how did you get interested in Disney? Set the story of your start.
Well, very briefly, I was in the right place at the right time. As a child, I grew up in Glendale, California, which is adjacent to Burbank. In fact, a 5-minute drive or 10-minute drive tops from Glendale will get you into the heart of Burbank, which is where the Disney studios are. And I attended Thomas Edison Elementary School in Glendale, and my first grade teacher was Mrs. Margaret Disney. Now, Margaret Disney was the second wife of Walt's older brother, Herbert, who was a mailman and was working as a mailman at that time, and his first wife had passed away. He had married a younger woman as his second wife, and she was teaching at Thomas Edison Elementary School. And, of course, my connection with Disney was, of course, every week watching the Disney television show. And so what I did is I took a large sheet of easel paper, and I drew a picture of Jiminy Cricket, because Jiminy was close to my name. I was called Jimmy in those days. Mm-hmm. And I gave it to her in the hopes that she would take it immediately to the Disney studios so that I would be hired so I wouldn't have to learn my multiplication tables.
On your sheer talent and, alone.
Well, it just didn't occur to me that Portfolio Review was backed up for a couple of decades. And so to this day, I still don't know my multiplication tables very well. But again, being in that location, it was a very Disney-fied atmosphere. And so when I was about 12 or 13, as I said, I was watching the weekly Disney television show, and I didn't know the difference between an animator or a layout artist or an in-betweener or whatever. But at the end of the show, the credit crawl would come up, and I took my school notebook, and I tried to scribble down as many names as I possibly could, because I was interested in being a cartoonist. I was interested in being an animator. And so I went to the Glendale Burbank phone book, and I looked up these guys' names and phoned them. Just did a cold call. You know, I saw your name on TV. I want to be a cartoonist. How do you do that, you know? And about 85% of them were just wonderful. There was 10% that thought it was some sort of gag that their friends had put up this 12-year-old, 13-year-old boy to phone them up and said, I really like how you draw cartoons. And then 5% were wrong numbers. And the very first animator I got a chance to talk to was Jack Hanna, who had directed most of the Donald Duck cartoons and Chip and Dale cartoons. And at the time, he had retired from the Disney studio, and he was teaching at Cal Arts. And I remember in that first interview, he was talking about this young kid in his class who he thought really had talent, John Lasseter. Mm-hmm. And so Jack was teaching character animation there, and so I guess he was in that mood to be very friendly to those who were interested in how animation was done. So I remember my mom driving me over on a hot summer day, and I was going to be meeting an adult, so I was wearing my church suit, which was solid black with a little thin black tie, so I looked really like a teenage undertaker. And I had my tape recorder, and I had my notebook, and I think he assumed, and I assumed, that it would be maybe about a half-hour interview. About 2.5 hours later, he said, gee, maybe I should have you stay for dinner. And I said, no, I'll call my mom to pick me up. This has been very gracious. And he says, you know, you should also be talking to, like, Ward Kimball. And he went and he phoned Ward Kimball.
Holy cow.
And he said, Ward, I got this kid here. He's really interested in all of this. And, you know, he should be taught. And I was like, what? And I talked with Jack and interviewed him many other times after that. But, again, I was in the right place at the right time. I started writing articles about interviewing these people for my school newspaper, and then some of those got picked up by the local newspaper, the Glendale News Press, and all that. And in those days, there were also And this is pre-internet days, so nobody knew anything. Now, thanks to internet, people know things, but it's all completely wrong. But in those days, we didn't know anything about Disney history. You know, there really weren't a lot of books out or things like that. So, you know, you're stumbling to get this information. But instead of the internet, they had what were called fanzines.
Hmm.
Now, a fanzine is a magazine that is put out by a fan. And so usually it was limited distribution. It could be done, you know, in mimeograph or Xerox or sometimes photocopy. And there were several fanzines out there that were devoted to Disney. There was Persistence of Vision by Paul Anderson. There was The Duckburg Times by Dana Gabbard. There was Carl Barks Collector. There were several, and I started writing for all of them. And then just like a snowball going down the hill, it gathered up, you know, speed, and I never figured I would be this old. And my gosh, I was maybe the only person who ever talked to such and such or wrote about, you know, Paul Murray's artwork for Mickey Mouse or whatever. So, again, I was just lucky. I was in the right place at the right time, and I had two very supportive parents who, you know, go ahead and call these guys, you know.
That took a tremendous...
If that's what you're interested in doing.
That was courageous for you just to call these people randomly as you scribble their names off the credits. That was very courageous for a teenager.
Well, looking back on it in retrospect, it's like, what was I thinking? But at the time, it was basically... Well, this person knows something, so I better ask him.
Okay.
And again, since I lived in Glendale, I was only about 40 minutes away from Disneyland, and so my family wasn't necessarily well off, but we did get to go to Disneyland at least twice a year, usually on my birthday and once in the summer and all of that. So I got to see Disneyland grow up before my eyes as well. And so, again, if I had, you know, been in Storm Lake City, Iowa, or whatever, I may have gone an entirely different route. But fortunately, by being in Glendale, my entire life was able to be corrupted by Disney.
That's a pretty good corruption to have.
As opposed to about writing on the farmer's news stories in Iowa, right, Jim?
So. Well, that's true. But remember, there's a very, and I'm sure your listeners know this too, especially after listening to the three of you for 99 episodes or whatever, that there's a very, very thin line between a Disney fan and an absolute addiction and obsession and possible serial killer.
Yeah, we're that
very, very thin
exactly.
line.
Exactly.
No, we're not that one. We're not that one. Sorry. Forget I said that.
So do you guys have another question for me?
Actually, Jim, I'm curious. I know... I believe I read this at one point that you were actually an instructor at the Disney Institute.
Oh, yes.
Where did you come up with as much information that you landed that job?
Oh, I just make it up. and who's going to check, right? Who knows?
Chris, no. we can do it.
What happened I grew up out in California, and around 1995, what happened was both of my parents were living out here in Florida, and they developed congestive heart failure. And they were going to move in with me in Los Angeles, but their doctor said that doesn't seem like a good idea because, you know, the smog will cause respiratory problems, and there's just a stress in Los Angeles if you've ever been there. So I sold my house at a loss. I quit my job, and I was a junior high school teacher, believe it or not. But I was also working at Six Flags Magic Mountain as a performer and a writer. And that's a whole other podcast. But in 95, I moved out to Orlando. And if you've seen Orlando, especially in 1995, unless you were working in the hospitality industry, you know, for a hotel or a restaurant or a theme park, there just were no jobs. And so I started at Disney doing magic and balloon animals at Pleasure Island for drunk college students. And then I was moved over to the Magic Kingdom, where I was Merlin the Magician. Oh, yes, looking for the new Sword in the Stone ceremony, King of England, oh, dear. And on weekends, Brass Pector Pat, an old gold miner.
Wow.
By golly, over here by Big Thunder Mountain. And so at that time, too, the Disney Institute opened, and I had a background in cartooning and animation. I am an animator and an artist, but I'm a good enough artist to know how really bad I am, that I'm much better as a story man. But anyway, I got a job at the Disney Institute, back when it really was the Disney Institute, teaching all of the animation classes, classical hand-drawn animation and how to paint a cell, and voices of Disney, how to do voices for different Disney characters and all, and computer animation and stop-motion clay animation, all of that. And as Disney will tell you, the Disney Institute was so successful, it could not be contained in one location. So they had to get rid of that location and three-quarters of their staff. Because the entire property was now the classroom. So I moved over to Disney Adult Discoveries, which were the behind-the-scenes tours. And so they're the ones who do classes, which I'm sure some of your listeners may have taken, like Backstage Magic, Hidden Treasures of World Showcase, Innovation in Action.
We just talked about them. Things. Yep.
And so I was brought on as an instructor, and I also then became a writer. I created various tours. The original version of Undiscovered Future World at Epcot was the first tour I wrote entirely by myself. And I also trained, and I did some instructing as well. And so I had a wonderful manager by the name of Kay Bundy, and she insisted that whatever you write, whatever you say, you have to have three independent sources to verify it. And because, again, you know, we're in an age where a lot of people just cut and paste, and I'm sure you've seen the same story or even the same sentence or same paragraph, you know, repeated constantly, and nobody ever checks to see if that's true. But Kay always insisted that those of us who worked for Disney Adult Discoveries that you know, people were going to go home and say, hey, I heard a Disney cast member tell me such and such. Mm. And she wanted it to be accurate, because a lot of times that happens and it's not accurate. So I got to meet an awful lot of Imagineers out on the East Coast. I had met a lot out on the West Coast, and got to go through, believe it or not, there were over a dozen different libraries out in Orlando. So, for instance, Imagineering had its own library. Animation had its own library. Entertainment had its own library. And none of these people communicated with
Holy
each other.
Holy cow, really?
So one library might have that piece of information that you needed, and nobody else did. And again, as a cast member, and I was personable, and my dad had always taught me to bring donuts. And so I was welcomed in and was able to gather an awful lot of this information. And then Disney Adult Discoveries started to get a little shaky. So I moved over to Epcot, where since I had written the Undiscovered Future World Tour, I was in guest relations. And so in guest relations, I had to learn even more. And, in fact, what Walt told the very first group of guest relations hostesses was, I'm only going to expect two things of you. Know the answer or know where to go get the answer. And so, fortunately, when I went into guest relations, that same philosophy existed. And so, my gosh, you had to know everything because you would have guests come in and ask all sorts of questions. And so you had to know that. Then I moved over to college and international programs. You know, you have college students who work at Disney, and you also have international students who are on a special visa. Well, they have to attend classes because otherwise it looks like what Disney is doing is bringing in cheap labor to sell Mickey ice cream bars.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the whole point of the visa, the whole point of getting college credit is that, yes, you're selling the Mickey ice cream bar, but you're getting that wider perspective of how the Disney business operates, the Disney history, the Disney heritage. And so since I'm a credentialed teacher, I ended up teaching 250 different classes.
Oh, wow.
That I all created myself. You know, some of them were like cultural immersion. You know, what is the difference? What is the Disney heritage with different cultures, and how do cultures interact? To things like, you know, how is Walt Disney World built? And again, this had to be factual and had to be researched. And then finally, I was moved over to the Learning Center, the Epcot Learning Center, which is sort of a combination of a computer lab and a library, but they also offer classes to cast members. So I would teach classes like the history of Donald Duck, you know, you know, the stories of Walt Disney and things like that. And then in, 2008, 2009, 1 week, Walt Disney World just decided to lay off 3,000 cast members.
Mm.
And then more the following week. And so even though I had won the Partners in Excellence Award and had all this recognition, I had helped Imagineering with projects, I'd helped the Disney Design Group and all that, they basically went, well, Jim, we're eliminating your role. So, you know, you can't sue for wrongful dismissal. It's just that role no longer exists, you know, as coordinator of the Epcot Learning Center. And so we wish you all the best. Thank you for everything.
Wow. Oh, my goodness.
Wow.
Ouch.
And so I figured, hey, look at all the stuff I've done. Look at all the people I know. I can get another job. And so I went to the casting center, and they said, the only opening we have is third shift custodial at Disney Animal Kingdom. And I said, okay, I can do that. I'll still be part of the Disney company. And they said, and it's only part-time. And I said, okay. I said, I can deal with 20 hours a week. I'll just get – they said, we can't even guarantee 20 hours a week as part-time. I said, well, as long as I know what the days are, I can go get another job. They said, no. We can't tell you in advance what days are going to be. They're going to change each week. And eventually the anvil fell on my head that those people that they laid off, some of them they just didn't want back.
Yeah. But you were the
you
keeper.
Know? And so yeah. I thought, okay, well, what can I do? And so one of the things I could do was write. And so I wrote my first book, The Vault of Walt. And Diane Disney Miller was gracious enough to write a foreword. At that particular point, she had only written a foreword for one other book in her entire life.
Wow.
But she said, I love what you write. It's truthful. I love what you when you write about my father, I can hear his voice. I can hear his laugh. She said, you know, you don't hold him up as a saint, but you don't demonize him either. You just present the facts. And so Vault of Walt became popular, and believe it or not, and this is an exclusive for this podcast. Nobody else in the world except my publisher and me know this. Coming out next week on Amazon is Vault of Walt Volume 6.
Awesome.
Awesome.
Because I never promote a book until it's physically out there. Because if you announce a book ahead of time, people go, is it finished yet?
Yeah.
And all sorts of things can happen. And so this is an exclusive for this podcast, is right before Christmas here, Vault of Walt Volume 6 will be out with new stories of Walt, new stories of the parks, new stories of the films, and new miscellaneous stories. In fact, in the miscellaneous stories, there's an entire chapter about the entire history of Duffy the Bear, because I figured nobody else in the world will ever write the history of Duffy the Bear.
It is true.
And years from now, somebody is going to, you know, go, what were they thinking? How did that? And so I go back to the teddy bear conventions that were held at, at Epcot, and then later at the Contemporary, and people don't realize that, and that there were special exclusive Disney teddy bears, and that led to the development of the Disney Bear, which, was supposed to kick off, you know, the world of Disney as a merchandise place, and then that evolved into Duffy and the whole bit. So if anybody ever wants to know about Duffy the Bear, Vault of Walt Volume 6, and it'll explain that, you know, we just need to blame Japan, because Japan yes. loves everything that's cute. Yep. And the Disney Bear just took off from there, and so all of those changes. So Vault of Walt, and then as you can tell from my history, I have connections with entertainment and Imagineering and animation and all of that. And so also I was starting to see that some of these people that I had talked to were passing away, mm-hmm. you know, without sharing their stories, mm-hmm. you know, with a wider audience that might be interested or might be, could find that information useful. And so I started to feel a real obligation that I need to get that information out there, even if I don't have everything that I would want. Because Disney history is like a huge, giant jigsaw puzzle. And I figured if I shared the pieces that I have, you know, somebody else might go, oh, I have a piece, and it fits right here, you know. And you get a better vision, a better perspective of the entire thing. And unfortunately, the Disney company, even to this day, really doesn't take time to document. It takes time. It takes money to do that. And so even when Walt was around, they didn't document. It was an oral history. So if a new person came in and said, well, I don't understand about Steamboat Willie, they would say, go down to special processes and talk to Ob Iwerks. He worked on that, and he'll explain what you need about that. It never occurred to anybody that these people might one day not be around, you know, forget, you know. Oftentimes when I interview people who worked at both Disneyland and Walt Disney World, they sometimes blend those experiences together, you know, and the chronology is sometimes off. So even though you go to, I always try to go to first person sources, you know, somebody who was there, an article that came out in a Disney magazine at the time or in the newspaper or whatever, but you can't always trust that. So I fall back on, you know, I've got to find three independent sources to help verify that because you've got to get the true story out there, because there's an awful lot of phony, fake stories out there, and as much as I love the bus drivers on Walt Disney World property, sometimes I'll be on a Disney bus and I'll hear something, you know, and they're trying to be entertaining, they're trying to be helpful, and it's like, this is just entirely wrong.
Have you ever corrected him, Jim, on the bus? Have you ever come?
No, you know what I do, and in fact, I just went on a tour, and the tour guide immediately recognized me, and I said, "Look, don't worry, I'm not going to say anything." I said, "But if there's something I have concerns about, I'll pull you aside privately or after. If you're interested, I will share that." Because last year, some friends pulled me on the Keys to the Kingdom tour. And the very first thing this perky little guest relations hostess said is she pointed to the train station and she said, "That's where Walt had an apartment so he could look out and see all the people in the park."
Oh my goodness.
And so, well, it gets even better than that. There was a quiet moment where, you know, people were going on a bathroom break and whatever, and I pulled her to the side and I said, "You realize that Walt Disney passed away in 1966, and physically the train station was not completed until 1971. And I said, "You may be confusing this with the bit of information that Walt had an apartment over the firehouse in Disneyland." And she looked at me with the sweetest, most condescending look, she goes, "I think we know what we're talking about."
Oh, no.
Oh,
this
goodness.
Script had to be checked.
Oh, no.
Oh, that's so hard.
And then later she pointed at a picture of Roy Disney, Roy O. Disney, and she goes, "And that's Walt's brother, Roy O. Disney, giving the dedication speech on October 1st. And so I pulled her aside again a little later, you know, when it was quiet, and I said, "Yes, the park opened on October 1st, but it was not dedicated until the 22nd, the 23rd, that weekend there."
Mm.
Well, and she just rolled her eyes. It's like, this is one of those Disney geeks who think they know everything, you know.
Yes.
If you knew everything, you would be working here.
Wow.
Yeah, I run tours at a museum and oftentimes have people pulling out their phones. And I know that they're fact-checking while I'm talking, and it distracts me a lot. But so you're such an amazing, amazing storyteller. And since we're in the holiday season right now, we were wondering if you had any stories to share about Walt or the parks or the company that focus on the holidays.
Oh, not a one. There's no connection whatsoever.
All right,
no,
folks.
No, actually, I'm so grateful that the three of you have invited me on for this podcast and especially this holiday season, because Disney and Christmas have almost become synonymous, you know, and just like the season of Christmas here, you know, Disney has brought so much joy, you know, to the entire world. And even starting with Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs in December 1937, Disney would always release usually a new film or re-release, you know, a film over the Christmas season. And so, you know, we would get connect, and of course, how many of us wanted, you know, Disney gifts for Christmas? The very best Disney Christmas gift I ever got, and it was from Disneyland, and it was the only, and it was so expensive. Looking back on it in retrospect, it was like, well, that's pennies. But at the time, it was so expensive, it was the only Christmas gift I could get. It was a Disney Art of Animation kit that was sold at the Art of Animation Gallery in Tomorrowland at Disneyland.
Wow.
And in there, they had this little press board animation table that you could put together with glass, and it had the animation pegs, and it had pre-punched paper, and it had how to draw Mickey and how to draw Donald, and it had a timing sheet and a pencil that said Disney Art of Animation, and it had two flip books and all of this, and it was in a kit, and gosh darn those Disney people, they stapled the sides the box, you know, so you can't open it, because again, you know, people could go in and pull out loose things, And so I remember going to Disneyland and picking that up, and then on the drive home, I'm sitting in the back seat with this on my lap, and I can't open it till Christmas.
Oh.
And, of course, one of the great things they offered, too, was that if you did animation, you could send it to them, and they would shoot it at the Disney studio on 8mm film and send it back to you.
Whoa.
But I was never good enough to do that. You know, it looked one way in my mind, but when I got it on the paper. But anyway, that was one of my favorite Disney Christmas gifts. And another one was getting the original edition of Illusion of Life, autographed by Frank Thomas and Ollie Johnston. And it was like, oh, wow, this is cool stuff. But, you know, Walt loved Christmas, but he didn't love Christmas in terms of, you know, what could I get? You know, I think a lot of us don't realize how poor the Disney family was. You know, Elias and Flora were, you know, trying to feed and clothe five kids, and Elias was just a terrible businessman. You know, he was either investing in jelly factories that were going belly up or, you know, whatever. And so Walt would only get a present that was useful, you know, like underwear, you know, or a pair of pants. And sometimes not even that, because Flora would take clothes from the older brothers, and she was quite the seamstress, you know, and do that. And then Walt, of course, fell into that situation. I don't know if you have any friends who are like this, too, who have a birthday in December. Mm-hmm. And so Walt's birthday, of course, was December 5th, and so he was told, we're not going to get you anything for your birthday. You'll just get something bigger for Christmas, see? So we'll combine that together. And it never works out that way. Never works out that way. And, again, you know, out there in Marceline, Walt would go out with his older brothers, and they'd chop down a Christmas tree, you know, a cedar or a pine, and drag it back home. And Walt would sit around the pot-bellied stove with his mom, and they would pop corn, and they would string popcorn and cranberries together.
Mm-hmm.
And Walt, ever the artist, would take little pieces of paper and use tin foil and make little stars and angels for the tree.
Wow.
You know, those were the decorations. And sometimes his older brother, Roy, who I don't think gets enough credit for a lot of things, but would put aside a couple of extra pennies so that Walt might get a top, and Walt's younger sister, Ruth, might get a little doll or whatever. That all came from Roy, who, you know, with that money he could have bought something for himself. He wanted to make sure that they had a little toy, you know, to play with at Christmas. And I guess the most amazing Walt Christmas story took place when he was 13. He was, at that time, you know, he was delivering newspapers. His dad was paying the other newsboys, but didn't pay Walt anything because he said, look, I feed and I clothe you, that's your payment. And so Walt would get up at 3:30 in the morning because he had to get to the corner by 4 o'clock for the papers to be dropped off, and then pick them up, and then go deliver them, and still try to rush, you know, to get to school by 7 o'clock. And so sometimes in the morning he'd be so tired he'd be up and he'd be sitting on the side of the bed, and he'd start to tie his shoes, and he would fall asleep, and his dad would yell, and he'd, you know, get up, and he had to deliver the papers in the morning, and then after school he couldn't stay and play with his friends. Because there was an evening edition of the paper that had to be delivered. And Walt did that for years and years and years. And he had to do it, you know, if it was snowing. You know, one time it was snowing so hard, Walt said, you know, the snow drifts were taller than I was. And Walt was often given to exaggeration, you know, in order to tell a good story. Mm-hmm. But again, you know, you do your fact-checking. I went back and I checked the weather reports in Kansas City for that year, and sure enough, there were snowdrifts that were taller than Walt.
Wow.
And he would have to go through that. He told his daughter, Diane, that sometimes he would have to, you know, climb up these icy steps, and he was a skinny, lanky a kid, and really wasn't getting a lot of food and not a lot of sleep. And he said sometimes he would just slip and fall down the entire flight of steps to the bottom, and he would just cry because there was no one around, mm-hmm. and he could do that, you know. And his dad insisted that the paper be behind the storm door, you know, and sometimes people wouldn't look there, and they'd phone Elias and yell at him that they didn't get a copy of the paper, and so Elias would send Walt back with another paper, you know, wouldn't listen to Walt, and Walt would knock on the door, and they'd open the door, and there was the paper between the door and the storm door, and it'd just fall at their feet, and they'd go, oh, we didn't know that. We didn't think to look there. And Walt said, they never thought to look there. And as I said, Walt didn't have toys, and so sometimes kids would leave out toys, and he would play with them. And there was a train, a wooden train. He played with that, and he said he told Pete Martin in 55, 56, when Martin was helping to do a biography of Walt, that, yes, he would play with the toys, but he was always very careful to make sure to put them back exactly in the place that he had found them, you know. And there was a half-eaten box of candy, and he took one or two of those to eat because he didn't have candy at home and all of that. So rough life for Walt. So he was 13, and I have a nephew who's 13. Going on 35. And 13-year-olds have very particular tastes about what they want, you know, in clothes and in music and things like that. And so this year he's getting gift cards because whatever Uncle Jim gets, it's always wrong.
Better boy.
So gift cards, I have no compunctions about that. So anyway, when he was 13, Walt wanted these pair of boots. Kids at school had them, and apparently they were pretty fancy. They had straps. They had a little metal thing around the side of it, and all this. And he went to his dad. And Walt, being Walt, goes, "Well, you know, if I got these boots, I'd be able to deliver, you know, the papers quicker. You know, I'd be able to get through the snow." And his dad wasn't, you know, buying any of that. And so his birthday came and went, and there was nothing. That's what he expected. And then on Christmas, underneath the tree, there was one box for him, and he thought, okay, well, this is, you know, clothes or something. And he opened it, and it was the boots. Mm. What had happened is his mother had put aside each week a little bit out of the housekeeping budget. Roy had gone and gotten a second job.
Oh, man.
And picked up extra money. They got him the boots. So what he did, being the showman he was, he ran down to Main Street and leaned up against the pharmacy, sticking out the boots. So that everybody who walked by could see him with, I've got these boots. Wow. See? And they're brand new, and look at this. And so it started to get late, it was a warm winter, so some of the ice had started to melt. And so as he was walking home, Walt decided he'd invent this new game, and it was kicking these blocks of ice, you know, and see if you can carom them off the sidewalk or shoot it underneath a horse or, you know, whatever. And so he's just, you know, full of himself, and he's strutting along the street here, and he's kicking these blocks of ice, and there's this huge block of ice, and so he winds up his foot, and he smashes into it, and he can't move. And he tries to twist, and nothing is happening. Inside the block of ice was a rusty horseshoe nail.
And when
he had kicked the ice, that nail had gone right through the boot into his foot. And so Walt was stuck. His foot was up there in the air. He couldn't bring it down. He couldn't pull it out, you know. And so he started yelling. He started waving. And he saw that people just went on because they thought, oh, look, it's a 13-year-old kid who's goofing around, you know.
That kid with the boots again.
and Walt said, you know, I was there for an hour or more. I'm sure he was there for maybe about 20 minutes. But he said he was there for an hour or more. And this guy in a horse-drawn cart, you know, comes by and stops. And Walt now has tears coming down his eyes, this 13-year-old kid. And he goes, please, please, please help me. And the guy just moves on. And then he stops and he looks back and he says, are you joking? Are you joking around? Walt said, no, I'm stuck. And so the guy came down, took a look, saw what was the situation, pulled out an axe from the back of the cart, chopped around the ice, had to pick up Walt because Walt wasn't able to walk, and carried him to a doctor that it was just down the block. And the doctor said, I'm sorry, kid, I got nothing to give you. And so the driver had to literally hold Walt down while the doctor got this, you know, huge pair of pliers to dig into the foot and twist and turn, pull a nail out. Now, in order to do that, he had to cut off the boot.
Oh, no.
And then had to phone his father to come pick him up. And so Walt, of course, what is going through his mind is, you know, what an idiot. Why was I doing that in the first place? I'm never going to get another pair of boots like this. My dad is now going to have to pay the doctor, you know, for what is happening. And the doctor says, you can't stand on that for 2 weeks. It's got to be elevated for 2 weeks. You know, they put in the rabies shot and the whole bit there. And so Walt was taken home. And so it makes it even worse. Walt can't do the newspaper route for 2 weeks. You know, his dad's got to hire somebody else to do this. Could this get any worse?
No.
And so Walt was in the living room, and he had to keep his foot, elevated, and he couldn't move. And his Aunt Margaret, the Margaret who was married to Uncle Robert, not the Margaret that I knew. This was another Margaret. A lot of Margaret Disneys, a lot of Robert Disneys, a lot of all Disney. But anyway, Margaret, who was the wife of Robert Disney, who Walt, you know, then later stayed with in Hollywood when he came out to California, she gave him a drawing pad and some pencils. But I don't think anyone listening here is old enough to remember this, but once upon a time, drawing pads used to be made out of the worst wood pulp paper you could find. Sometimes you could even see little bits of, you know, wood in the paper itself, because again, it was just, you know, the stuff that you would throw away. So Walt started drawing because he knew he wanted to be a cartoonist, which is one of the stupidest things he could have done, because of course there are no animated films at the time. There are no comic strips. The only cartooning is editorial cartoonists, and most papers already had an editorial cartoonist, and those guys just took forever to retire. But Walt decided he wanted to be a cartoonist, and so he would draw these things, and his mom wanted him to keep up with his schoolwork. So every morning she would take his homework to school, and then in the afternoon she would go and pick up, you know, the new assignment to bring home. And on the way there was a barber shop, and she would drop off some of the cartoons that Walt was doing. And the barber just loved them. Sometimes he would post one on the window, and he said, you know, when your son gets well, I'll give him a haircut for every cartoon he does for us here, and, you know, all of it. And Flora would come home and tell Walt and, you know, how much they laughed at that and they loved that. And at that moment, Walt decided he was going to put all of his focus, all of his energy to become a cartoonist. And so, you know, this Christmas season, when you give a gift or you receive a gift, look at it very closely, because it might be that one gift that can transform your life. It can change, you know, the entire world. Imagine if Walt had not been laid up for 2 weeks. You know, he might have ended up working at a jelly factory, or he might have been working as an animator for some fly-by-night company in New York. There were a lot of them that, you know, came and went type of thing. But it was the gift of those boots that gave us the Walt Disney that we know today. How's that for a Christmas story?
That's amazing.
That was the most brutal Christmas story with the best ending I've heard in a long time.
And again, I got to hear Walt Disney tell it. Now, I never knew Walt Disney. I never met Walt Disney. But in the summer of June and July 1956, Walt did a series of several hours of interviews with Pete Martin. Pete Martin was a writer for Saturday Evening Post. And they wanted Walt to write his autobiography. And Walt says, I don't want to do that. He says, but I'll tell you what, why don't you have my daughter Diane? I want to encourage her, you know, to be a writer. And so they paid her, you know, a fourth of what they would have paid Walt. But she and Pete Martin out in the backyard at the Holmby Hills house, you know, just off of Carrollwood Drive there, sat down, and Walt spent hours telling the story of his life. And those tapes still exist today. The Disney Family Museum has them. And it ended up being a series of several articles for the Saturday Evening Post, and then later was combined into a book called The Story of Walt Disney by Diane Disney Miller, and in little tiny type, Pete Martin. And Diane said, that is so wrong. You know, Pete Martin did all the work. Yeah. I just sort of sat there and listened to what my dad was saying. And my gosh, if you go through that book, you'll see that Pete Martin didn't do his checking. He just believed Walt. So if Walt said, yes, in 1930 we did such and such, and was like, no, that was 1933, whatever. So if you're going to get a copy, get the limited edition copy that was released in 2005, you know, for Disneyland's birthday there, because that reprint has an appendix where Dave Smith goes through and makes all the corrections.
Oh, wonderful.
And the reason they did it for the 2005 Disneyland thing is because they sold the original copy at Disneyland, autographed by both Walt and Diane Disney, $5.
Oh, my gosh.
Wow.
$5.
Oh, my gosh.
Autographed by both. Authentic autograph. It's not Walt's secretary doing this, or Hank Porter, or Floyd Godfredson, or any of those people that Walt, you know, gave permission to, because, you know, there were so many people wanting autograph cells and things like this. Personally autographed by Walt, personally autographed by Diane. There's got to be a ton of those out there somewhere in some old bookstore or whatever to track down. But I heard Walt tell this story. And again, he could tell it much better than I could. And But oh, what a great story, right?
Jim, could I?
You want to hear another Walt Christmas story? Or you know, you want to hear a story about the Disney parks?
You know what? Either one. I didn't want to. I wanted to be considerate of your time, but if you have time for one more story, I sure love it. Whatever you would like to tell us.
Oh, sure. Okay. You know that Walt married Lillian in 1925.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened there was. Walt and Roy bought houses that were right next to each other. It was on Lyric Avenue, and these were prefab houses, you know, where all the wood is already pre-cut, everything mm-hmm. like that. And so it's like an IKEA house. You can put together your house. So they were mirror images of each other. And so now that Walt really has, a house he can call his own, one of the things that Walt really wanted was a dog. Walt loved dogs, you know. He had a puppy back on the Marceline farm that he just loved. When he was serving with the Red Cross Ambulance Corps over in France, he got himself a little German Shepherd puppy. And his friend Russell got one as well. And Russell left early, so he took both of the puppies. But apparently Walt died somehow. And there's still some, how did that happen type thing. When Walt came back and his older brother Roy said, you know, it was really funny. Walt was more upset about that his puppy died than the fact that this girl he was writing to had got engaged to another guy and not told him. So anyway, Walt wanted a puppy, wanted a dog, and his wife Lillian, absolutely no. You know, Lillian is such a great part of Disney history because she is always telling Walt no. You know, Walt says, we're going to do color. No, don't do that. That's too expensive. We're going to do a feature. No, don't do that. I'm going to do Disneyland. Why would you want to do an amusement park? They're so dirty. She was constantly saying no, and why that is important is because it made Walt work harder to make it make sense and make it work. So he really had to work through, you know, what am I going to do? So she didn't want a dog. So Walt, of course, being Walt, does all this research, you know, and why don't you want a dog? Well, they smell, you know, they shed and all of this. And so he got this, spent days doing this research and comes to her and says, well, I've done this research and a chow, you know, has very little odor, doesn't shed, you know, goes through all of that. And Lillian goes, that's wonderful, but we're not getting a dog. So Walt immediately goes out and buys a chow puppy.
Oh no.
Which he keeps there at the kennel until Christmas Day, which is when he brings it over to Roy's house. All right. And so Christmas Day, they're celebrating in Walt's living room. You know, the family is there. There's a huge, big tree. He has a niece, Marjorie Davis. And I had to do this as a kid. I don't know if anybody else did, but at these family gatherings, you're the one who has to pick up the present and give it to each of the people there, you know, so not every person right. comes to the tree. And when I was a kid, Mom and Dad dressed me up as an elf. So I'm scarred for life in many actually, much more so because my mom said everybody has to get one present before somebody can get a second present, which didn't work out because Aunt Edna, not everybody got Edna's present. Oh. Aunt Edna was a whole story of her own. And here's this little elf desperately looking for an Aunt Edna present to give so that other people can get their second present. So anyway, Marjorie Davis, his niece, is giving out presents. And so she's in on what's going to happen. Walt goes to Roy's house, gets a big hat box, puts the little puppy in there, puts a big ribbon around it, puts in a little tag that says, "To Lily from Santa." And Walt comes back in and sneaks it underneath the tree. And so Marjorie is these out, and then she pulled, and she says, "Oh, wait, there's another present here." And she pulls it out and it says, "To Lily from Santa," you know, and everybody knows it's obviously going to be from Walt. And so I talked with Marjorie about this, interestingly enough, and she said, so I picked it up and I started to walk towards Aunt Lily, and she said, I could see the steam coming out of her ears because she thought Walt had bought her a hat. And she felt that Walt had no taste in hat at all. And so this was the greatest effrontery that in front of everybody else, she's going to have to try and pretend to like this awful hat. And so Marjorie said, I could just feel time slowing down as I moved towards her. And she said, and I just set it on her lap, and I backed away very quickly. And you could see, she said, you could see that Lillian wanted to say something. And then suddenly the hat box moved. And Lillian screamed, and peeking out from the hat box is this adorable little puppy. And it's a chow puppy, and Lillian names it Sunny. And Walt said, it was the biggest mistake I made in my entire life, because from that moment on, that was her baby.
Oh.
Aww.
It slept with us in the bed. If we let it out at night to do its business and it didn't immediately come back, Lillian sent me out with a flashlight to try and find what had happened and all of that. Now, Walt, being the great storyteller that he is, told this story, you know, at the studio. People remembered it. What happens in Lady and the Tramp? Lady and the Tramp, the only Disney film that begins at Christmas and ends at Christmas. And basically what has happened is Lady is a little Cocker Spaniel. She's in this hat box with a ribbon.
Oh, yeah.
She pokes out just the same. Mm-hmm. And in fact, if you come down to Walt Disney World and on Main Street, there's Le Chapeau. And Le Chapeau is the hat shop there, and it's right next to Tony's restaurant. The logo, the sign for Le Chapeau that's between the hat shop and Tony's restaurant is a hat box in the same color and same striping as from Lady and the Tramp.
Hmm.
How many people noticed that?
I didn't notice that.
I will look for it, though, now.
11 out of 10 people miss it. That's what I tell.
Wow.
And again, you know, when you're in a Disney theme park, you don't notice these things because they seem right.
Yeah.
So subconsciously you feel, yes, there's something right about this. You know, so you don't look at the bottom of the steps of Tony's restaurant and see in the sidewalk that they have a heart with an arrow and two sets of dog paws. You know, just mm-hmm. exactly as it is in the movie Lady and the Tramp. You know, Imagineers call those ahas. You know, we're so tied in with hidden Mickeys and all of that.
Yeah.
Basically, what an aha is you don't see it anywhere, you know, in any of the literature or whatever, but you stumble across it and you go, aha!
Mm-hmm.
And so those are there, you know. It's just, you know, one of those wonderful things, you know. And the parks, of course, are wonderful at the holiday season.
I was going to ask, Jim, can I ask for one more from the parks, please, you know?
Sure. I was going to say that, you know, I'll lead into that by saying Walt even wanted Christmas there at Disneyland in 1955 because, you know, even though, you know, he owed millions of dollars because when Disneyland was built, they couldn't afford to pay certain bills, so they took some bills and they just shoved them into a chest drawer. And it wasn't until a month after Disneyland was open that they found in this drawer that there were tons of unpaid bills. And so also, you know, as soon as summer ends, kids don't come to Disneyland anymore. So everything is dropping, you know, before the Christmas season. But Walt still wanted there to be, you know, a Christmas at Disneyland. So he brought in Charles Hirt, H-I-R-T, who is the choral director at USC, and he brought with him a dozen Dickens carolers that went throughout the park. And Hirt was the one who, in 58, created the Candlelight Processional. And the Candlelight Processional was done because Hirt would bring in these local choirs and all of this, and sometimes they would stand around the flagpole in Town Square and all that. And Walt basically came to him and he said, can you do some show that I can just watch from, you know, my window, you know, over the firehouse? And so they came up with the bleachers in front of the train station to create the living Christmas tree. That's why that's there, is because Walt wanted, when he was at the park over the holiday season, you know, to have a little holiday show right outside his window. But anyway, they had a tree to the side of Sleeping Beauty Castle. They had a tree on the bow of the Mark Twain, that's where the twinkle lights on Main Street come from. Is from that first holiday season. Hmm. He went to people like Bob Gurr and said, you know, can we do something, you know, to light up these things, you know, to get this done. Now, here's another Christmas story, and this is one that's sort of sad but sort of inspirational. This is from Jack Lindquist, and this is for that very first Disneyland Christmas, all right? And what that was is it was late at night on Christmas Eve, Lindquist, who was in charge of marketing at that time, he was there and he was watching, you know, people leave the park, and there was this family, a father and a mother and a little boy and a little girl, and they were looking at the windows of the Emporium. And Jack told me, and I think Jack wrote about this in his book, In Service to the Mouse, but Jack told me that, you know, it was obvious that they were, you know, they had tried to dress well, but obviously they, you know, didn't have, you know, an awful lot of money. And in those days, people who went to Disneyland dressed up, you know. They dressed up in suits, you know, and women wore gloves and pearls and stuff like this. So, anyway, they're going, and the little girl is looking in the window, and she turns to her mother and goes, you know, you were right, Mom. This is better than having Santa Claus come visit. Mm-hmm. And Jack said, I knew at that point they had the choice of coming to Disneyland or buying presents for the kids, and that's what they had chosen. And he said, you know, if it was in my authority or whatever, I would have taken them right in to the Emporium right then and there and say, pick out whatever it is you want, you know. And Jack said that image, the reason I'm telling you this story, Jim, is that image just stuck with me about what Disneyland means to so many people, and why we do what we do, and why we shouldn't be cutting corners, and why we should be doing, you know, all of this stuff. And unfortunately, last year, you know, we lost Jack, and fortunately, he had written a book. Unfortunately, he was in the middle of writing his second book, and you know, that's why it's so important to get those stories out there and share them. And that's why it's very important. Those of you who are listening to this podcast, especially regular listeners, that's why this podcast is very important, because it gets those stories out there. It keeps those stories alive. And yes, I was laid off by Disney, but I will tell you that the way I survived is I realized you can love the Disney brand. You can love those characters. You can love going into the park, which can be a very, you know, healing moment, and still have concerns about how the Disney business operates. You can separate those two things, you know, and I think a lot of people do.
Jim, you are a fabulous storyteller. I was looking over your complete library of what you've written and on Amazon and on Theme Park Press. And
again, you know, talking about Walt's boots and unexpected surprises, if I had not been laid off from Disney, I could not have written those 20 books. Because as a Disney cast member, I would have had to submit those for approval. Huh. And it is not just a case of factual, you know, well, we're going to send this to Disney Archives and we're going to send this to Imagineering, whatever. It has to go through brand and it has to go through synergy. And I still write for Disney Publications, and I had an article rejected for one word.
Wow.
I was writing about the Princess Fairy Tale hall at Walt Disney World, and I said it's an annex to Cinderella's Castle based on the classic Disney animated feature. And I had written 1,000 words. They were going to not pay me and not run the article because of one word in that sentence. And I said, I talked to Jason Grant, who was the Imagineer, who was in charge of the design here, and he called it an annex. And he said, you know, the bricks here are similar to the bricks on Cinderella's Castle. The problem was I had called it a classic animated feature. And who was ever in charge of review that day felt that that meant it was old. And I said, you can take that out. You can take that word out. I don't care.
Yeah.
And they said, we can't do that because we don't, you know, we don't edit a writer's work. If you want to take that out, yes, take it out immediately and
right
send
now.
Me my check.
Exactly.
But the funny thing is the week before I had written for another official Disney publication, and I had used the word classic to refer to an animated film, and that got by. And, there's an inconsistency there, and so that's very frustrating. But if I was still working for the Walt Disney Company, as opposed to just being an outside contractor and vendor, all of those books would have had to gone through, and they would have said, because I've been told this too, they would have said, well, you mentioned Pleasure Island. You can't do that. We don't want people to remember Pleasure Island. We want them to know what's there now. I said, but I'm mentioning it in a historical context.
Yeah.
That that's what was there first.
Yeah.
You know, and that some and now it has been reimagined.
Well,
not good enough, Corcus. Not good enough.
well, you should know that when the Disney when the Disney Vacation Club magazine comes to the house, my kids love to look in the back pages for the pictures, and my wife looks at the cover. I stop them all, flip back about 3 pages off the back cover, and I say, this is what you should be reading in the Disney Vacation Club magazine, is this article right here. The most recent one was on Snow White. And
right. It wasn't amazing how much information was packed into those 2 pages there?
That's the best part of the magazine, so no doubt. With your 20 books, if someone's listening and hadn't picked up any of your works, would you recommend...
Shame on them.
Yeah,
shame on
no
them.
No doubt.
It's Christmas and I'm an orphan.
Right? No doubt. What would you start with? What would you tell a person to pick up? What would be book number one?
Well, I think it would depend on their area of interest, because Disney fans are such a broad group. Some are only interested in Walt. Some don't care about Walt at all, believe it or not. Some are interested in the park. Some are interested in animation. Some are interested in whatever. I would say if you want to dip your toe into the Jim Corcus library, you should pick up the revised Vault of Walt, Volume 1. because you have seven stories about Walt. You have seven stories about the park. You have seven stories about films. You have seven miscellaneous stories, including the story of Walt's housekeeper who died a millionaire-ess but didn't know it.
Mm.
Huh.
It was Thelma Howard, and there's some wonderful Thelma. I hope you guys are going to invite me back again sometime. But Thelma Howard was a wonderful housekeeper, wonderful cook. But what Walt would do is he would give her Disney stock on her birthday and at Christmas. So it ties into Christmas again, along with something else. But it would give her the Disney stock, and he said, hang on to this. This might be valuable someday.
Wow.
And so she just kept taking it and never checked.
Wow.
And when she died, it's $1 million.
Wow.
And so half of that went to her son, who was a child who had special needs, and half went to a charity. And apparently she lived comfortably. You know, I guess you don't need $1 million to live. You could live comfortably without that. But, yes, she had no clue that she was a millionaire-ess when she passed away, thanks to all of that Disney stock.
Wow.
And
where is the preferred way to buy this? Could you buy it on Theme Park Press or Amazon?
Amazon.com is a good place to start. And those who are interested, always look at ThemeParkPress.com because not just Jim Corcus books, but there are also some wonderful other Disney books. But that will also keep you up to date on what books are coming out. I told you that Vault of Walt number 6 is coming out next week, but just recently released a book that I'm very proud of is one that is called Call Me Walt, Everything You Never Knew About Walt Disney. Now, it's not another biography. I've got two or three dozen Walt biographies on my shelves already. Most of them are pretty poor. And there is nothing about Mickey Mouse, nothing about Disneyland, nothing about audio animatronics, nothing about Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. What I do is I approach Walt as a human being.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have a chapter about his brother Herbert. You have a chapter about his brother Ray. You have a chapter about his mom and dad. You have a chapter about the Disney coat of arms. There are 12 chapters that debunk the most common Walt myths, you know, that Walt was frozen, that he was born in Spain, whatever. And again, these chapters aren't just Jim Corcus saying, well, Walt was a nice guy. He wouldn't have done something like that. On the Frozen chapter, I went and I talked to the president of the only cryonics company that existed in the world when Walt passed away.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things he told me is he goes, you know, especially in those early days of technology, what you do is if somebody dies, you have to freeze them immediately. Or if possible, freeze them just before they die, you know, so that there's no deterioration going on in the body. In Walt's case, they left him in the hospital bed there for a couple of hours so the family could come and say their goodbyes. Mm. And then I dug up Walt's death certificate, and on there you have the cremator, and he puts in his number, and he puts in his seal. And so I track him down. And he goes, yes, Mr. Disney was cremated. That was his wishes. That was the wishes of the family, and I carried those out.
Wow.
And then I also have the location of where those ashes are interred there. But I do that. But also I have other chapters, you know, things that people, I think, would be interested in knowing, like how tall is Walt Disney? How much did he weigh at different points in his life? Where did he go buy his clothes? You know, what different cars did he drive? What were the different pets that he had during his lifetime? Where are the different places that he lived, including the Smoke Tree Ranch? And I talk about hobbies he had that most people don't realize. Lawn bowling. You know, if I said, well, name me a hobby that Walt had, I think most people would jump and say, well, trains or polo or whatever. Walt was a part owner of the Santa Anita Racetrack, had a box there, you know, and also out at Hollywood Park. But lawn bowling, he bowled at the Smoke Tree Ranch. And in fact, he designed the bowling green for it there. He bowled in, did lawn bowling in Beverly Hills, and actually took the members to a tournament in Philadelphia, I think it was. And he was talking about, if he had lived, that he was talking about taking them to a tournament in Australia. He had his own hand-sewn bag to carry the little balls, which were called bowls. And to this day, there in Beverly Hills, they have an annual Walt Disney lawn bowling tournament,
wow,
which is international. And the perpetual trophy at the bottom has Walt's four personal lawn bowls, the bowling balls.
Mm-hmm.
And at the top is a gold statue of Mickey Mouse. How many people knew that?
No.
And again, the reason for writing that book is I am just fed up with all of these people who, well, Walt Disney had a dark agenda, and, you know, he probably couldn't even draw Mickey Mouse, and blah, 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 blah. And so here are the facts.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was again, right place at the right time, but very grateful, very thankful that I knew Diane Disney Miller personally, and that she talked with me, and that she sent me a lot of emails. And so in the book, all of the things there, I don't make any assumptions. I don't make, well, Walt did this because he was thinking, no, here are the facts.
Mm-hmm.
Here's when Walt went to Hawaii. Here's when Walt, you know, yeah, did this. So, you know, and hopefully that will help people in the future. You know, right now we're talking so much about sexual harassment and all of that. In there I print a memo that Walt wrote in the 1930s, which was posted, which said, it has come to my attention that men are using crude terms and language around women. It has always been my belief that girls and women who work here should feel comfortable and safe, and so you need to cease that immediately.
That's amazing.
Isn't it? And yet you'll have somebody like a Meryl Streep go, well, Walt didn't care for women.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, yes, he loved his mother, you know, his wife, his two daughters, his niece, you know, the female nurse at the studio, Thelma Howard, the mm-hmm. housekeeper, for crying out loud. There were nothing but women in Walt's life, and he listened to them. He aggressively wanted their input. And yes, most of the women worked in ink and paint, but he gave jobs to women in story, in animation, you know, and you take a look at people like Alice Davis and Mary Blair and all that. So women were in positions of authority, you know, when Walt was in charge.
Well,
you know and racism. I have a whole chapter on that. And again, you know, we usually think, you know, in terms of being racist, you know, against people who are black, and Floyd Norman's one of my really good friends, and he said, and here's something too for people who've never read Call Me Walt, because you won't find it anywhere else. Floyd said, Walt hired me personally. Walt, you know, promoted me to story man, which was the highest status in the studio. He said, you know, but there was a black janitor at the studio, Claude Wilson, and he said, Claude, when you're a janitor, especially a black janitor, you're invisible. You know, you could go around the studio and people are talking, they don't even see you. And he said he never heard Walt say anything that was racist. He never heard anybody say that Walt was racist. Mm. And in his free time, Claude served as a bartender for Walt's parties out at the Holmby Hills house off of Carrollwood Drive. And Floyd said, you know, we talked privately, and so if there was any reason for concern, Claude would have told me, mm-hmm. so that it was like, you know, watch your back, you know, be careful about this, do that. He said, none of that. During World War II, Walt had Japanese artists working at the Disney studios, and he went into this one young lady who was working there, and he says, are you doing okay? You know, what are you telling people? She says, well, if people ask, I tell them I'm part Korean, I'm part Chinese, I'm part, you know, this, and I'm part Japanese. And Walt says, don't do that. If people ask, say, you're an American, because that's what you are, and it's none of their business, you know, and if anybody is giving you a hard time, you come and let me know.
Yeah.
And she said, Walt was so concerned about me and every other Japanese artist that was working there, that they would not be singled out. Now, that doesn't mean that there weren't racists and anti-Semitics who people who were working for Disney, because Floyd told me he was up for a job in layout, and the guy who was in charge of layout felt, Floyd said he was uncomfortable working with a person of color, so I didn't get that job. He said, but I ended up being a story man. I enjoyed it much more, and that was hired. So call me, Walt, everything you never knew about Walt Disney, Amazon.com or ThemeParkPress.com, and the good Lord willing, maybe there'll be a couple more books coming out this new year, and this podcast might want to have me back and tell a couple more stories.
Jim, as you're speaking, I'm literally adding it to cart right now on Amazon.com. Shit. So,
amateur, so. Mine's already been ordered and paid for.
Jim, you've been awesome, and we appreciate you giving us this much time. You know, it was exactly what we wanted. We knew we wanted to get one of the best storytellers we knew, so we certainly appreciate it.
Well, consider it your Christmas gift.
Thank you.
Consider it your holiday gift, your Hanukkah gift, your Kwanzaa gift.
Everything. Excellent. If do you have a way? I know that you're not on social media, on Twitter or Facebook. How could someone?
Listen, I've got more than enough trolls out there.
Yeah, I imagine so. Is there an email through a website or anything?
If people want to contact me, if they go to mouseplanet.com, I write a weekly column there every Wednesday. And so there's a section there where you can click and you can contact me.
Perfect. That's wonderful. Okay. Yeah, excellent. Well, again, thank you.
And so, again, as I told you, very thin line between Disney fan and insanity. So if those people who have crossed the line, this podcast...
We'll take care of them. Don't worry, Jim.
I'll have a story for you next time.
Yeah, no doubt. You let me and Pete know. We'll take care of it for you. No problem. Thank you, Jim. We appreciate you coming on with us today.
And the happiest of holidays to you and to all of your listeners. And as we used to say at Walt Disney World, may every day be a Disney day.
Wonderful.
Thanks for coming
Absolutely.
On,
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
That was one of the most interesting hour plus long conversations I've had with anyone in my life.
We could have had like a 3-hour show right there, right?
Fast. 3 hours, not a 3-hour tour.
3-hour tour.
Yeah. No, 3-hour tours. Okay. I can't do island for the rest of my life.
Well, what he said, Pete, was off the air, was that whenever you guys want to have you back on, so we're going to have Jim back on.
Yeah.
A couple more times.
Absolutely.
So.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Cool.
So, well, I think that's going to kind of bring us towards the close of our big 100th extravaganza episode here. I personally want to thank a couple of people for always supporting the show, whether, you know, she wanted to or not. My wife will listen to the show as long as I have her captive in the car. Thank you for that. Chris, for always being the guy that's willing to do the tech stuff, whether you know how to do it or not, you're willing to
so true
to fake it till you make it.
The knot, absolutely.
To Laura, our original third co-host, you know, life sometimes gets in the way, and that's fine. We completely understand. She's always welcome to come back. To our new co-host, Stacy, thank you for joining us and making us sound not quite as silly as we did when it was just the two of us.
Here, here. Dilly dilly.
And to all those other people, you know, the theme park brothers and, you know, all the travel agents and our friends in the travel agency industry and, you know, most of all the cast members that we get to interact with when we go down to our favorite place in the world. Thank you for giving us a reason to do this.
Mm-hmm. Stacey, how about you?
Well, I jumped in the right time, I think, with becoming a co-host. Cause, you know, right at the 100th episode is a pretty good time to start working with you guys. But I want to thank both of you so much. You've made this transition into this new journey that I'm taking really, really easy. And it's literally like talking to a couple of friends every week. So thank you both for being so supportive and patient as I'm kind of getting used to things here. But then just to my family, same reason as Pete, just for kind of, you know, allowing me to take this chunk of time each week. And we have a 3-year-old, so sometimes that can be a little bit tricky with schedules, but they've been really great with that. And then just all of my friends and family, whether they're Disney friends and family or not, just for being supportive and encouraging and really just taking the time out to listen. And of course, to all the listeners, thank you so much for helping to make this podcast so awesome.
So true. I want to say thank you to my wife for putting up with this. I want to say thank you to my mom for being my number one fan. And, you know, for everybody that we've had on the show as a guest, for everybody that has given us the time and been supportive when we were starting off, I want to thank you. I would forget everybody. But I don't want to forget anybody, and I hate to even say names, you know, the Michaels and the Amys and the Lisas and the Tamaras and Scott and everybody, but I'm going to forget people. So for the incredible people that we've met and become friends with and text with on a daily basis, that's really why we do the show, is we've built up those relationships, and it feels like you're just talking to family now. So thank you for your support. All right.
Chris's mom's also my number one fan. So.
It's true.
I got a birthday card from the woman. She'd never met me in her entire life.
She's pretty amazing, I have to say.
She prefers Pete than her own son. All right. So for downloading and listening to us, we appreciate it. Like you'll never know, we do. And for my buddy Pete, for my buddy Stacy, thank you. Have a great day.
See you, everybody.